If you are one of our regular listeners, you have heard over the years about how Pampers Swaddlers were an integral part of my girls' lives when they were in diapers. That is because I always depended on Swaddlers to make my life, well, easier. They keep your baby's skin healthy and dry with Pampers Breathe Free Liner, which wicks away wetness, allowing your baby's skin to breathe. There's also the blowout barrier at the back waist to help prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Swaddlers have always given me peace of mind knowing that leaky diapers were not in our future. And since I love Swaddlers, they're always my go-to baby shower gift. Now, with the new Pampers Diaper Stash, gifting and receiving diapers is a whole lot easier. Diaper Stash is an online diaper fund where you, your friends, your family can contribute to a group gift of an online diaper stockpile. It is the gift that always fits. Take the guesswork out of choosing what size and how many diapers to gift. Here's how it works. Create a surprise Diaper Stash account for a new parent or expecting parent in your life. Then share the account with friends and family so they can also contribute. From there, watch your stash grow, and when it has reached its goal, gift the stash to the parents-to-be. They can use the stash funds to buy Pampers diapers and wipes anywhere they'd like. For any new parents in 2024, the Pampers Diaper Stash is the best new way for friends and family to say, "We got you." Cecilia Marquez is retelling the history of the American South with Latinos at the center. She has a new book out, Making the Latino South, and in it, Cecilia takes us back to the 1940s, when she argues that non-Black Latinos were on the road to whiteness, attending white schools and living in predominantly white neighborhoods, to the early 2000s, when a combination of post-9/11 xenophobia and an economic downturn targeted those same communities, creating what would become a dramatic racial evolution. Cecilia, who is now the Hunt Family Assistant Professor in History at Duke University, shares how these histories inform modern-day political identity and how writing this book informed her thinking about her own identity. Cecilia, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
I'm excited to talk about your incredible work, your incredible book. But first, I have a burning question that the Google did not have an answer for me on, which is, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Arlington, Virginia, which, depending on who you ask, is or is not the South. If you ask my family in Georgia, they would tell you, of course, I'm not from the South. And if you ask the kids I went to school with outside of Philly, they would tell you I'm from the Deep South.
But it's not your experience growing up in what is arguably the American South, so much as it is this moment when you're at a conference about the history of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, that seems to me in the retelling to really crystallize for you this area of inquiry. What is it that happens there that sets the light bulb off over your head?
I am a junior in college at Swarthmore College, which is right outside of Philly. I'm in a Women in the Civil Rights Movement class, and I go to Shaw University, which is just down the street from where I am now in Durham, North Carolina. And I get to interview all of these civil rights activists that I'm learning about in class, these luminaries of the movement. And one of the people I met there, his name was Luis Zapata. He was a United Farm Workers organizer who had come to Mississippi to help organize the Mississippi Freedom Labor Union. And so it was the last day of the conference. I chased this man down and was like, "Can I please talk to you? Who are you? I've never met anyone who was Chicano or Latino and involved in the Southern Civil Rights Movement." And so I got the chance to talk to him, and he introduced me to some other people. And so that was really the moment that it crystallized for me that I was interested in studying the radical social movements in the South, but I also wanted to study Latinos. And here was this moment that I could do both.
The American South, often understood to exist as a racial binary, white Americans, Black Americans. At the outset, as Latinos are beginning to integrate into the American South, where do they fall in that binary?
The book really goes from 1940 to 2010, and I suggest that before the 1970s, non-Black Latinos lived something like what I call provisionally white. Non-Black Latinos could live in white neighborhoods, attend white schools, intermarry into some white families, but they couldn't do all of the things that Southern whites could do. They couldn't join certain kinds of fraternal organizations. They couldn't join the Klan. They were still Catholic. They still had Spanish surnames. There were still things about them that kind of marked them in certain ways. part of what I look at when I'm looking at Latinos in the history of Jim Crow in particular is the way that Latino history is segregated between Black and non-Black Latinos. And so Black Latinos are living in the South alongside African Americans, and non-Black Latinos are living alongside white Southerners. And so it's really a kind of fractured community at this time. When Latinos start to arrive in the South in big numbers in the 80s and 90s, the first time that we start to see a kind of coherent Hispanic identity in the South, it's really around this idea of the hardworking Hispanic immigrant. And that's not just from Latinos, right? That's also from factory owners. It's from politicians, some of whom were conservative. Part of what I argue is that it has to do with the economy and economics and the fact that in the Southeast at this time, manufacturing and food processing is exploding at the same time that it's declining in other parts of the country. And they need this labor. And so one of the ways that they recruit this labor is talking about them in ways that seem welcoming and exciting.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. What I love about Shopify is that no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Latina, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Latina now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Latina.
Hi, everybody. Juleika here with a confession. Like many of you, I've been drinking coffee since before I could walk. But lately, I've been happily sipping on herb teas from Tadin, a Latina-owned company based in Los Angeles for over 40 years. There's just something about their teas that takes me home emotionally. Like Tadin's Té de Manzanilla that calms my spirits. And the chamomile tea reminds me of my grandmother. And their lemon and ginger tea is perfect for that mid-afternoon work slump. Enjoy them hot or cold. Or get creative with the easy recipes on Tadin's IG and website. That's tadin.com. Happy sipping!
If you are one of our regular listeners, then you have heard over the years about how Pampers Swaddlers were an integral part of my girls' lives when they were in diapers. That's because I always depended on Swaddlers to make my life, well, easier. They keep your baby's skin healthy and dry with Pampers Breathe Free Liner, which wicks away wetness, allowing your baby's skin to breathe. There's also the blowout barrier at the back waist to help prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Swaddlers have always given me peace of mind, knowing that leaky diapers were not in our future. And since I love Swaddlers, they're always my go-to baby shower gift. Now, with the new Pampers Diaper Stash, gifting and receiving diapers is a whole lot easier. Diaper Stash is an online diaper fund where you, your friends, your family can contribute to a group gift of an online diaper stockpile. It's the gift that always fits. Take the guesswork out of choosing what size and how many diapers to gift. Here's how it works. Create a surprise diaper stash account for a new parent or expecting parent in your life. Then you share the account with friends and family so they can also contribute. From there, watch your stash grow, and when it's reached its goal, gift the stash to the parents-to-be. They can use the stash funds to buy Pampers diapers and wipes anywhere they like. For any new parents in 2024, the Pampers Diaper Stash is the best new way for friends and family to say, we got you.
So you have this moment in the 90s where, as you say, there's almost a welcoming environment for white Latinos in the South. And then things shift, and they shift fairly radically. To what do you ascribe that shift?
There's two things I think that happened. The first is 9/11. And 9/11 produces a massive growth in the police and surveillance state, right? So things like 287G programs, which make it possible for local police officials to collaborate with immigration officials to basically make it easier to detain and deport people than ever before. Those things expand dramatically in 9/11 at the same time that there's growing nativism. And then what cinches the deal is in 2008 with the Great Recession. And this is a story that we know throughout American history. when the economy is bad, Latinos and immigrants in general are scapegoated. They are seen as drains on precious welfare resources, drains on jobs for quote unquote real Americans. And those same Latinos who in the 1990s were welcomed as hardworking immigrants got to live long enough to see themselves reviled as quote unquote illegal immigrants.
And so where does that leave us today?
There are still sort of increased nativism, anti-immigrant sentiment that still exists in the South. We've seen a kind of return to some of the earlier 287G type programs. It is also true that Latinos have now been here for a longer time. And so we're starting to see the institutionalization of some community organizations, community leadership, state leaders, political leaders, those kinds of things that are really cropping up out of the work that Latino communities have done over the past 20, 30 years.
I have to admit that when I originally was introduced to your work, Cecilia, I thought it was about how Latinos reshaped the American South. And really, you're asking a more dynamic question, which is, how is the American South and the experience of being Latino in the American South reshaping Latino identity? I very much understand it as it relates to Latinos who live in the South. Is there an extrapolation to the way in which the South changes Latino identity that applies even for Latinos who don't live in the South?
I mean, I think a couple things. One is that the system of Jim Crow and the way that race was organized in the South required Latinos to make certain decisions that maybe they didn't have to make in other parts of the country. But what the South really makes clear is the way that Latinos are sorted based on their relationship to Blackness, and that Black and non-Black Latinos have very different experiences of race and the world. I mean, I heard the author Natasha Alford on your podcast a few weeks ago and her great book, America Negra. I mean, these are the stories that are being told now, which is understanding the very different experiences that Black Latinos have across the United States. And the South really shines a spotlight on those differences because of the way race worked. But those are stories that are not unique to the South. I mean, one of the things I always want to be clear is that Latinos don't come to the South and learn racism, right? Anti-Black racism is something that Latinos have in Latin America. They have in Texas, they have in California. And it might look different in the South, but the South isn't where we're learning anti-Black racism, certainly.
Here's the thing I would love for you to help me tease out. We talk about white Latinos. We talk about Black Latinos. What about the Latinos who don't identify as either? I'm thinking specifically of mestizas. Mm-hmm. How do they get coded in a system that is seen as a binary?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that the book shows is that that system changes over time, and it's a very dynamic system, and it's one that evolves based on our economic situation, our political situation. So what it means to be mestiza, what it means to be brown might change dramatically over one's lifetime, even. One of the questions that we often get asked is like, are Latinos going to become white?
Are we like the Irish and the Germans and the Italians?
The Italians, right, exactly. And I think that we can sort of resoundingly say, like, if it was going to happen, it would have happened. You know, we've been here as long as all of those groups and it didn't happen. And in fact, in my book, the opposite happened. Latinos lost whiteness over this time period, which is to say someone living in Mississippi in the 1940s would have probably found more racial acceptance than that same person living in the 2010s. The reality is that what it means to be Latino, and this is one of the big points of my book, depends on when and where you are. And so what it means to be mestiza in Mississippi in 1990 is quite different than Iowa in 2010. And so kind of where we're being Latino shapes us. If there's a takeaway from my book, it is that we have been in the South for a long time, and that means that we get to claim the South. We get to say that the South is Latino. It also means that we have to be accountable to those histories and the ways that we are embedded in those long histories of white supremacy and have benefited for that, for those of us who are non-Black.
Cecilia, I want you to tell me how you end up with a dad who teaches you about Jewish history on butcher paper with markers.
My father's family is from Venezuela. They migrated there from Spain. They were Jews who were expelled from Spain during the Inquisition. You know, so goes the legend, right? So that's how he taught me to love history. I mean, we spent Saturday or Sunday mornings learning about the Torah and learning about Jewish history and those stories. And for him, it was really a connection to his roots, to his philosophies, to his identity, all of these different things. And that became really important to both me and my sister.
Well, it also just strikes me as such a 2020 fascinating parallelism with what will become your life's work, which is to think about people who've been displaced, who've had to recreate identity in the wake of an existing identity structure. So when German Jews end up in Venezuela, They had to figure out where they fit in the context of a society that had not presupposed them.
Yeah.
And they go on then to remake it.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think my dad's story in some ways is emblematic too of the way that time and place really shape it, which is he immigrated to Philly to go to graduate school in the 1970s. And his experience is going to be quite different than the Venezuelans who are immigrating today, right? Who are economic refugees, who are asylum seekers, who are in a really different economic, but also political situation than he was. And so thinking about what is, you know, if we're just like, what is the Venezuelan experience? What is the Latino experience? I mean, that is a pretty dramatic difference.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. What I love about Shopify is that no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Latina, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Latina now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Latina.
If you are one of our regular listeners, then you have heard over the years about how Pampers Swaddlers were an integral part of my girls' lives when they were in diapers. That's because I always depended on Swaddlers to make my life, well, easier. They keep your baby's skin healthy and dry with Pampers Breathe Free Liner, which wicks away wetness, allowing your baby's skin to breathe. There's also the blowout barrier at the back waist to help prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Swaddlers have always given me peace of mind, knowing that leaky diapers were not in our future. And since I love Swaddlers, they're always my go-to baby shower gift. Now, with the new Pampers Diaper Stash, gifting and receiving diapers is a whole lot easier. Diaper Stash is an online diaper fund where you, your friends, your family can contribute to a group gift of an online diaper stockpile. It's the gift that always fits. Take the guesswork out of choosing what size and how many diapers to gift. Here's how it works. Create a surprise diaper stash account for a new parent or expecting parent in your life. Then you share the account with friends and family so they can also contribute. From there, watch your stash grow, and when it's reached its goal, gift the stash to the parents-to-be. They can use the stash funds to buy Pampers diapers and wipes anywhere they like. For any new parents in 2024, the Pampers Diaper Stash is the best new way for friends and family to say, we got you. There was a note about your mom, Cecilia, in your book, which let me know that you and I would have been childhood friends, which is her clearly trying to get you outside of your own perfectionism and understanding that sometimes, you know, good enough is enough. I wonder what that looked like as a child, and also if you are still struggling with that today.
I am. Yes, don't worry. I have, you know, therapy on Thursday. It'll be fine. I mean, what did that look like when I was a kid? I was one of those kids who was, I think, equal parts blessed and cursed as a member of a gifted and talented program. You're like, on the one hand, this is great. Thank you for the resources. On the other hand, I've now developed a complex that I need to be special and overachieve for the rest of my life, that I will now spend thousands of dollars in therapy trying to untangle. Thank you. And I think that academia certainly doesn't make that easier. But I think that what I sort of came to in the end was that this is a book that is important and timely and something I just wanted to get out. Like, I wanted to get it out because there are so many. I mean, I see this. I teach at Duke University. I'm in North Carolina. And increasingly, our Latino students are local. There are students who are coming from North Carolina. They're coming from Georgia. And they're hungry for this history. And I was lucky enough to do an event recently with a bunch of Hispanic teachers in the North Carolina area. And they're also hungry for this history. They want to be able to tell stories to their classrooms full of young Latino and Hispanic students. And they want to be able to tell them stories of their own history here in the South. And so I think my perfectionism had to sort of take a back seat, both because of what I see as the political urgency of a book like this and you know, other kinds of professional requirements of my job. But yeah, I'm still working with it every day.
Cecilia, when you talk about the urgency of this political moment and understanding Latino identity, I wonder to what degree you're talking about the villainization around Latinos and to what extent you're talking about Enrique Tarrio and the Proud Boys.
Yeah, I'm actually working right now on a book about conservative Latino politics with a focus specifically on grassroots conservatism and trying to understand from the 1970s to today what that looks like. So, you know, we think about the 80s and 90s and the rise of the right. We think about white moms and dads and suburban white families sort of rallying against gay marriage, rallying against feminism, all of these kind of evangelical groundswell. And I'm like, where are Latinos in this story? So I think that it's absolutely correct. There, on the one hand, it is about understanding how the villainization of Latinos is as much a product of our economic and political moment as anything, and has actually nothing to do with Latinos themselves. And trying to understand the history of Latinos such that we can perhaps better understand some of the political identity, political decisions that people are making, because places like Georgia and North Carolina are pretty up for grabs right now. And with increasing numbers of Latinos, Latino voters are going to make up a bigger and bigger portion of the South and our voting population. And so as we think about what is the future of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, I think a lot of that is going to be decided here in the South.
Cecilia, how has the process of writing about Latino identity shaped the way you think about your own Latino identity?
Totally. I have the word Latino emblazoned across my book. Like, I teach Latino history classes. Like, that is my brand, right? For lack of a better word. And I'm also someone who spends like my full-time job being like, also, this category may not be working. This category might actually be too kind of corroded by its anti-Blackness, its anti-indigeneity. It might actually not be helping us. You know, for so long, I think I was trying to wrestle with what it means to be Latino and also be white. And in some ways, this book was really a way to help me reckon with the fact that these are not mutually exclusive categories. To be white and to be Latino is in no way mutually exclusive and is a product of a historical process that I kind of show up at the end of. That was sort of what I was trying to help us think about.
Cecilia, when you talk about the possibility that Latino is a category that potentially no longer serves us, and I like that you are still in process on this, that you've not distinctly come out on one end and made a decision, what then?
It sort of depends on, like, what are we using Latino for, right? Like, if we're using it as a way to signal our politics, then it's totally useless, right? Like, it means that me and Marco Rubio are sitting at the same table and somehow have something politically in common. False. If it's helping us understand kind of on-the-ground political activity, I still don't think it's really telling us very much. It seems like the divide between rural and urban is as instructive as anything. College, non-college, female, male, queer, non-queer, you know, all of these different categories are as instructive. It seems like Latino isn't actually kind of like an axis on which we can get much information. I think about like what's happening in Atlanta right now with the Stop Cop City activism that's going on right now. And it is led by Black, Indigenous, and Latino people who are invested in prison abolition, who are invested in Indigenous sovereignty, who are invested in land back movements. And it's a kind of like a political affiliation that is, of course, racialized, but is also connected to a kind of a deeper political situation that they share. And so I wonder if there's a way for us to think about, and this is something that Kathy Cohen, who is a political scientist, has famously written about, but what it would mean to build affinities based on our kind of political situation vis-a-vis the state. And that's like a very fancy way of saying, like, what does it mean to say, like, I am targeted by the police, you are targeted by the police, we have this in common, or I experience sort of victimization by ICE, you experience it by the police, let us sort of have a collective understanding that the police state is failing. I wonder if Latino is the kind of affiliative category that can actually hold anything, and or if it's actually that we need to be sort of based on our political alliances, based on our community ties, coalitions, those kinds of things I think feel really promising to me.
Cecilia, what did I miss?
So, you know, when you ask sort of like, where does that leave us? I think I'm sort of thinking about how that leaves us politically. But I think one of the things that's also changing, and this gets to this question too about what is the future of Latino, right? Is that we have an increasing, especially here in the South, increasing number of immigrants coming from Guatemala, from El Salvador, from Nicaragua, who are Indigenous and who are coming to the South and don't identify necessarily as Latino, right? They identify as Maya. They identify with their like Indigenous communities that they're coming from, which I think also helps us really complicate this category of Latino. Like, is it about being from Latin America? The question is, if Latino is a category that isn't serving the Indigenous folks who are arriving here, and it isn't serving Black people who are here and don't feel seen in that category, who is it serving? And so I think this recent Indigenous migration here in the South, and I have a colleague, Yuri Ramirez, who writes more about this, I think is helping us really think through the limits of that category, but also how all of these social service organizations and community institutions that were formed in the 1990s and the early 2000s, how those are having to adjust to this totally new population. And I think it's also one of the cool and exciting things that's happening in the South. Again, thinking back to that question of kind of affiliative politics, which is to say, what does it mean to have folks who identify as Maya living in the same place as folks who identify as Lumbee Indian in North Carolina, right? Native peoples of this area. So there's some exciting and interesting stuff happening there.
Cecilia, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
This was really fun.
Thanks for listening. Latina to Latina is executive produced and owned by Julie Galantigua and me, Alicia Menendez. Virginia Laura is our producer. Kojin Tashiro is our lead producer. Trent Lightburn mixed this episode. We love hearing from you. Email us at hola@latinatolatina.com. Slide into our DMs on Instagram or on Threads and TikTok at Latina to Latina. Check out our merchandise at latinatolatina.com/shop. And remember to subscribe or follow us on Radio Public, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Good Pods, wherever you're listening right now. Every time you share this podcast, every time you leave a review, you help us to grow as a community.